Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I do not think it altogether inappropriate to introduce myself to this audience. I am the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I've enjoyed it. I am also happy to have an opportunity to express publicly my appreciation to President and Mrs. de Gaulle for the hospitality and kindness which they have showed to us since our visit to Paris. I must say also, as I said to the General, that my most vivid impression of my visit here was not even the extraordinary spectacle which we all witnessed last night, which reminded us of the long reach into history which this country possesses, but rather was the sense of vigor and vitality and force possessed by the French people themselves. I do not say that riding in a car through rainy streets is the best method of making a determination of national character. But I have ridden through many streets, and I must say it is a most effective method of determining the quality of a people. And I think any American who shared the experiences which we have had during the past 2 days, in the sunshine on occasion, in the rain more often, would come away from this country with a feeling of confidence and hope. I come on the same mission which occupied many of my predecessors, stretching all the way back to President Wilson at the conclusion of the First World War. And that is how it is possible to bind more intimately for the common interest France and the United States, Europe and the United States. This is not altogether a new effort. I recall in my first days in the Congress of the United States in 1947, 48, and 49, when the great steps which were proposed on a bipartisan basis by the American people to assist in the restoration of Europe were among the most foresighted and farsighted actions in which my country has been engaged. The Truman Doctrine, the British loan, the aid for Greece and Turkey, the Marshall Plan, and later NATO. The United States, I believe, can be proud of these programs and of the great results that they helped to produce. Without them, it is possible that the whole history of Western Europe since 1945 would now be entirely different. Even today, the basic concepts suggested in these programs form the essential part of the foreign policy of the United States. But these concepts alone are not adequate for our European policies in the 1960s. All of the power relationships in the world have changed in the last 15 years, and therefore our policies must take these changes into account. First is the change in Europe itself. In the 1940s, Europe, much of it was destroyed. Its productive capacity liquidated, divided by a bitter war, inflation rampant, and only those who were optimists of the most extreme sort could have ever predicted the astonishing renaissance of Western Europe today. Its people have energy and confidence. Its economic growth rate is higher than that of the New World, either Canada or the United States. Its dollar shortages have been converted into balances which have even disturbed the monetary stability of the United States. There were those who said that Europe after the war would be a prisoner again of its ancient rivalries. Today, this continent offers the world the most outstanding examples of strength through unity. After 15 years of extraordinary creative effort and administrative invention, the development of the OEEC, the European Payments Union, the Iron and Steel Community, Euratom, the Common Market, and the OECD. And all of these have only laid the foundation for an even closer economic and political unity. At the same time, the wise and sympathetic policies followed by France and Great Britain towards those countries which were formerly dependencies have strengthened the free world, the globe around us, and have also increased the prestige and influence and stature of the countries themselves. The second great change is the change in weaponry. The United States no longer has a nuclear monopoly. The Soviet Union's possession of atomic and hydrogen weapons has increased its willingness to test and probe and push the West. In addition, the intercontinental ballistic missile have made my own country vulnerable to attack. And it has also reinforced our view that your defense and ours is indivisible. That in terms of potential destruction, Washington today is closer to Moscow than this city was to any other city in any other country before the outbreak of World War II. We must, in short, be constantly strengthening all of our forces of all kinds, at all levels, deterring war and keeping the peace by making certain that those who would oppose us know that we are determined to resist aggression, whatever its force and whatever kind of force is needed to resist it. The new change in weaponry presents new challenges. With possession by both the United States and the Soviet Union of an atomic and hydrogen capacity, with the great masses of armies that are available to the Sino-Soviet bloc, for the close lines of communication which they have at their service in Western Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Southeast Asia, it indicates the kind of difficult problems that we face in planning for a secure future. But while we keep our arms so strong that no antagonist can believe that he can secure an easy or shortcut road to world domination, man's inventive power for keeping the peace has not kept pace. We still have strong hopes that it will be possible for us to reach an agreement at Geneva on a cessation of nuclear tests. If we cannot reach an agreement on this subject, which is relatively easy to patrol because of the flow of radiation, how is it going to be possible for us to set up the kind of inspection system for the control of other weapons which could lead to disarmament and therefore to a world peace? I consider this to be a most essential, realistic step. And those of you who in this audience may have reported on the proceedings in Geneva in the 1920s and 30s, when many months and years and energy of a great many different countries were engaged in the subject under far better conditions of goodwill than prevailing, the subject of how to secure an adequate disarmament system which provided security, can judge how difficult it will be for us to do so in the future if we cannot make successfully this step. Third and most important is the change in the location and the nature of the threat. The cause of freedom is under pressure all over the world, but because of the extraordinary rebirth of Western European strength, the struggle has been switched to other areas where the security of your countries and mine are now being directly threatened. The whole southern half of the globe, where the attack potentially comes not from massive land armies, but from subversion and insurrection and despair. Europe has conquered her own internal problems. Those that remain are on the way to solution. The time has now come for us to associate more closely together than ever in the past in a massive and concerted attack on poverty, injustice, and oppression which overshadow so much of the globe. When the threat of military aggression was the primary one, our posture was defensive. But where the contest is one of human liberty and economic growth, and I tie them both together as we must always do so, because the slogans with which we have associated ourselves have significance and force when they are bound together with a recognition that economic growth and productivity and material well-being are the handmaidens of liberty. We have the resources in this most extraordinary section of the world, the oldest, and in many ways now among the youngest, allied with the United States and Canada, associated with the countries of Latin America and Africa and Asia, we have an opportunity in our time to fulfill our responsibilities. In 1779, before France came into the War of Independence, someone said to Benjamin Franklin, "It is a great spectacle that you are putting on in America." And Benjamin Franklin said, "Yes, but the trouble is the spectators do not pay." We are not spectators today. We are all contributing. We are all involved here in this country, here in this community, here in Western Europe, here in my own country, here all around the globe, where it is our responsibility to make a maximum contribution.
Le président a accepté de bien vouloir répondre aux questions que nous lirons pour gagner du temps. Les questions seront lues tantôt par moi pour les correspondants français ou étrangers et par M. Redmond pour les correspondants anglo-américains. M. Redmond lisant ces questions en anglais et en français. Première question. M. Fontaine. En cas d'échec des pourparlers d'Évian, les États-Unis pourraient-ils être amenés à se mêler plus directement du règlement de l'affaire algérienne?
It is, of course, our hope that the talks now proceeding at Evian will be successful. And I can think of no useful purpose at the present time in planning for the eventuality which was suggested by the question. We should look forward to the present. We should look forward to the effort which is being made to work out a peaceful solution. If that effort should fail, then, of course, all of us who are concerned would be expected to participate in appropriate consultations. But for the present, and certainly as we look to the future, we look with hope towards those talks.
Question from the Los Angeles Times. Will the President indicate how and how soon he hopes to induce the negligent European member states of the North Atlantic Alliance to fulfill their accepted force goals for NATO's European shield forces?
Without accepting the presumptions upon which the Los Angeles Times places the question, I am hopeful that all members of the NATO Alliance will fulfill the goals to which they are committed. I think it's important that in making these goals, we make them realistic, that we do not make plans that we have no intentions of keeping. So quite obviously, I think it would be in the interests of all that we meet our commitments. And I can assure you that the United States of America will make every effort on its part to carry out its obligation. I will say also that I'm interested in the effort which Western Europe and the United States and Canada are making through the OEEC, through DAG, to play a more substantial role in economic assistance to the southern part of the globe. This is a great challenge for Western Europe, so that we hope that all of us will be willing to bear the burdens that free people must in dangerous days.
Question de messieurs de Segonzac et de la Rue. Avez-vous discuté avec le général de Gaulle des essais atomiques français et de l'attitude de la France à l'égard de la conférence de Genève sur la suspension des essais nucléaires? À quel stade du développement atomique de la France la loi McMahon n'interdira-t-elle plus au président des États-Unis de lui livrer des secrets américains? Qui aux États-Unis est juge que ce stade est atteint ou non?
Answer to the first part of the question, the answer was we have discussed these matters. In answer to the second, the determination or the interpretation of the McMahon Act is a matter of concern to the executive and also a matter of great concern to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy of the Congress. And I'm sure that if a question were raised in regard to the interpretations that the United States government would attempt to make an appropriate determination. The third part of the question is what degree?
Qui aux États-Unis est juge que ce stade est atteint?
Who in the United States is the judge as to whether this stage has reached or not, whether this stage at which the United States can.
The responsibility falls most immediately on the President. It is a matter, of course, which it's a statute of the Congress. It is a matter of great concern to many members of the Congress who have given this matter long attention. There are varying views on how it would be interpreted. And I would say that the United States government would make a judgment, if a judgment were required, after consulting with our partners in the Congress. May I say that on some of these matters, my answers will be less than full and less than satisfactory to you. When this press conference was first planned, I expected to be at the end of my voyage. It comes at a time when, before General de Gaulle and I have concluded our talks, before a communique has been issued, and beginning tomorrow, I face new responsibilities. And therefore, I hope that those who I leave less than satisfied will at least be sympathetic.
Mr. President, a question by Serge Fliegers of the Hearst newspapers. What, in your opinion, Mr. President, is the principal aim of a meeting with Mr. Khrushchev at this time, and do you feel that you are meeting him with enough cards in your hands?
To answer the second part of the question first, I consider the power of the United States, plus those countries that are associated with it in the common defense, to give every form of encouragement to any Western leader who discusses matters which concern us with those who occupy positions of responsibility in other parts of the globe. I think Mr. Khrushchev has the same view. And to the first part of the question, I would say, as I have said before, that the purpose of this meeting is to permit me to make a more precise judgment on those matters which involve the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union and those countries which are associated with us and those countries which are members of the Sino-Soviet bloc. We are involved in two conferences at Geneva. We hope that more progress can be made at both of them. And if there is any thing that may be said in the meetings at Saturday and Sunday which may improve that prospect, then of course that makes the trip worthwhile. There are other matters also on which we have not come to an agreement with Mr. Khrushchev. And I think it important that we understand fully his viewpoint and all of its implications, and that in return he has the same understanding of our viewpoint. I said recently that in my lifetime that I had been present, alive, during three world wars, and it is impossible to study the origins of each of these struggles without realizing the serious miscalculations which were made by the leaders on both sides. The most recent example was in our own experience in Korea, where the North Koreans did not seem certain that we would respond immediately upon the occasion of their invasion into South Korea, and where there was a serious doubt on the part of the United States that the Chinese communists would intervene as we moved to the north. In the experience of Europe, you have had similar circumstances. Therefore, when responsibility is pressed heavily on anyone to make a judgment, it seems to me useful to have as close a understanding of the view of each side as possible. I think that it's most valuable to talk to those with whom we're allied. I also think it's important that we talk to those who are separated from us, because in the final analysis, heavy decisions rest constitutionally upon the President of the United States. He must, under some conditions, make the final judgment himself. And if my judgment may be more lucid, it may be based more on reality as a result of this exchange, then I think the trip will be useful.
Monsieur Kurt Kornacker, voudriez-vous nous interpréter votre accord sur Berlin avec le général de Gaulle? Quels sont le véritable sens et la portée de cet accord?
The matter of Berlin, of course, will be a matter of, I'm sure, of discussion tomorrow and Sunday. And therefore, I do not think that this is a particularly appropriate time to go into details on the position which we occupy in Berlin, as it is a matter, of course, which will be discussed by Mr. Khrushchev and myself. Let me therefore sum it up by saying that I think that neither General de Gaulle nor I would feel it appropriate to have our rights, statutory rights in West Berlin, changed by force or the threat of force.
Crosby Noyes, Washington Evening Star. Mr. President, in view of the attitude shown by the Soviet and Chinese delegations at the Geneva Conference on Laos, do you now feel that the neutrality and independence of that country can be established and ensured by an international agreement?
I think that the prospects are not easy of securing an independent and neutral Laos as we understand it. But we intend to continue to discuss this matter. And we will stay at the conference for as long as we feel that there is some hope of success. The Soviet Union has stated on occasions that it wishes a neutral and independent Laos. If we can come to an agreement on the exact precise definition of these words, then our progress should be swift. I will say that the first and most essential step at the present time is to provide an effective mechanism for controlling the ceasefire. If we can secure a ceasefire, then we can move on to those other matters which must be settled by the conference. It is a difficult area. It presents us with many difficult decisions. But I cannot believe that anyone would imperil the peace by failing to recognize the importance of reaching an agreement in this country by breaking up a conference and refusing to agree to a ceasefire and a government and a people which can maintain their neutrality against outside intervention from whatever source.
Question de Madame Geneviève Taboui et question annexe d'un autre confrère. Comment le président Kennedy voit-il le rôle de la France en Europe? Estimez-vous que des consultations plus étroites puissent avoir lieu entre Washington, Londres et Paris sur les problèmes politiques et militaires mondiaux?
Yes, I do, and the reason I came to Paris was to participate in that kind of consultation. Consultation does not always, regardless of how long it may go on, does not always provide unanimity at the end of the consultation. But there is a more precise understanding of those areas where there is agreement, and there is a more precise understanding of the reasons for positions which may be taken on which there is not agreement. So I regard conversations such as I have had for the last 2 days, and they have been more than 8 hours with President de Gaulle, I regard them as most valuable. And I believe that more than talking about consulting, it's important to consult. And we have done that, and we'll continue to do it, I hope with increasing intimacy, in the months ahead.
Question of Thomas Cadet of the BBC and Christopher Johnson of the Financial Times. Mr. President, did you discuss Britain's entry into the common market with President de Gaulle, and what did he say? And does the United States advise the French government to facilitate the entry of Britain into the common market as a full member?
I cannot believe that Mr. Cadet or Mr. Johnson have been in Paris less time than I have, but nevertheless, I'm sure that even if they've been here only in the last few hours, they would know that on those matters on which, regarding General de Gaulle's views, that the most authoritative place to secure them is General de Gaulle.
Question de Monsieur Jean Schwebel et de Monsieur Daniel Cazel. Que peuvent faire les États-Unis et leurs alliés pour être de nouveau considérés dans le monde entier comme les vrais défenseurs de la liberté et de la justice, alors qu'aux yeux des pays sous-développés, ils apparaissent aujourd'hui comme les défenseurs des seuls privilèges dont jouissent les Blancs en raison de leur niveau de vie élevé. Pouvez-vous nous dire, pour l'Afrique et l'Amérique latine, avec quels moyens les États-Unis envisagent d'aider les peuples de ces continents à faire leur révolution pour la paix et l'égalité, pour l'ordre et l'indépendance, ainsi que vous l'avez dit vous-même?
I think the question suggests a basic problem which is not easy to solve. We are a prosperous people. Some of us in the Atlantic community have held colonial possessions, and we therefore have not always experienced in my own hemisphere or in Africa or Asia the happiest relations with the people who are involved. But I will say, on the other hand, that the record of the last 15 years is an extraordinary one, as country after country has gained its independence by free means, in many cases, in fact, in the majority of cases, who were once held as colonial possession. This is an extraordinary record for the Western world, and one not matched by the Eastern world, which continues to hold areas under its control, not by free means. I think that it's not enough, as I said in my speech, that we give our slogans, though the slogans cloak very basic principles. But I feel we must make a greater concerted effort than we have made in the past on a long-term basis to demonstrate to these people that through free choice, they may be able to solve their material problem. I do not want to see the United States, and I'm sure that those of you who are Europeans do not want to see Europe associated with reactionary groups within these countries who seek only to maintain their own position. We want to assist and be associated with those groups who look to the future, who are identified with the aspirations of their people. Otherwise, our days in some of these areas are on the yellow leaf. I would say that one of the matters which I discussed with General de Gaulle was the great hope which we had in the Western Hemisphere that Europe would play an increasingly larger role. Its traditional ties, its cultural affinities, its ties of language of Latin America are extremely intimate with Europe. And I believe there is a great opportunity for Europe not only to serve the general cause, not only in Africa and Asia, but also in the hemisphere of the Americas. And it was a source of great satisfaction to me that General de Gaulle, as he demonstrated in his speech of some weeks ago, shares strongly that view of the obligation of this area.
NBC News presents tonight the fourth of the series, The President in Europe. This is Leon Pearson. President Kennedy tonight has come to the end of the first mile, or should we say the first kilometer. He has been entirely among friends. Tomorrow he crosses the Bridge of Sighs into fateful conversations with an adversary. And our report this evening aims to bring you an appraisal, a realistic appraisal, of the conversations with President de Gaulle and to project into the encounter with that wily and resourceful foe who awaits him in Vienna. It is the practice of diplomacy to write an epilogue to an official meeting by issuing a communique. Here is Sander van Oker in Paris.
The official communique issued today at the end of the talks between Presidents Kennedy and de Gaulle was not rich in specifics. These communiques never are. But it did say there had been frank and searching talks between the two presidents, which covered a wide range of problems. The Soviet Union, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, including aid to underdeveloped countries. These conversations, said the community, had shown the fundamental agreement which exists between the two presidents. In particular, President de Gaulle and President Kennedy confirmed the identity of their views on their commitments and responsibilities toward Berlin. The communique also said the conversations had allowed both presidents to know each other and to set forth fully the respective position of the two countries, taking into account the interests and responsibilities incumbent upon each of them. Left unsaid in the communique was that one agreement reached was for better consultations between the two countries in the future. Sander van Oker, NBC News, Paris.
A communique of another kind comes to us in a Reuters dispatch from Paris. Reuters, the British news agency. For 20 years, Harold King has been Reuters' bureau chief in the French capital. Tonight he writes, and I quote this particularly because it is a British view of our president, not an American. President Kennedy won the deep respect of France's often austere leader, General Charles de Gaulle. And another quote, the success of the president's visit went far beyond the popular acclaim he received from the people of Paris. For 2 days past, we've been reporting to you that the two presidents avoided the obstacles that lay between them. Tonight, John Rich in Paris considers this, but with another factor added.
President Kennedy has successfully completed the first leg of his European trip. In a few hours, he heads for Vienna and a much tougher challenge. He disclosed today that he expects Nikita Khrushchev to press him hard this weekend on the subject of divided Berlin. In turn, he's going to make clear that agreement for a ban on nuclear testing must come before any general world disarmament for which Khrushchev is pushing. The president revealed this insight into his thinking for the Vienna meeting as he wound up a 3-day state visit to France, one which both sides are describing tonight as extremely successful. In a clear warning to Khrushchev, President Kennedy said in his speech today that both he and de Gaulle agree they would feel it inappropriate to have their statutory rights in Berlin changed by force or the threat of force. He said he still has strong hopes that a ban on nuclear testing can be reached at the conference in Geneva. And he adds that if we can't reach an agreement on that subject, how is it going to be possible for us to set up the kind of inspection system for control of other weapons? The president has been deeply engaged in a working dinner all evening at the American Embassy residence here in Paris. His top advisors are now here mapping out strategy for Vienna. Dean Rusk, Averill Harriman, Arthur Dean, Ambassador Thompson from Moscow all are on hand, and they take off for Vienna in the morning. The meetings with de Gaulle came to a successful conclusion late this afternoon. The communique stresses friendship and cooperation. Mr. Kennedy himself said that he goes on to Vienna, his confidence bolstered by his visit to Paris. The French tonight appear tremendously happy. There was straight talking on both sides, and the communique indicates they covered a wide range of subjects. There were differences between the young president and the aloof old general, and nobody here is trying to conceal them. But at least the air has been cleared, and both sides now know where they stand. There will probably be a much more direct line from now on between the White House and the Élysée Palace. This is John Rich, NBC News, Paris.
It was a touchy business for the president to hold a conference with newsmen as he did today, and he was obliged to handle some of the hot ones by tossing them neatly aside. There was a question, Have you discussed with General de Gaulle the French atomic tests? To which he said, quite candidly, we have discussed these matters. But then the questioner wanted to know when the president would be free under the McMahon law to pass along U.S. secrets to France. Well, here Mr. Kennedy's answer was a rather amusing exercise in evasion, ending with a line, I hope that those of you whom I leave less than satisfied will at least be sympathetic. At the opening of this news conference, by the way, the president identified himself by saying, I am the person who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I have enjoyed it. Now, some questions, as asked, with answers, in the president's own voice.
What, in your opinion, Mr. President, is the principal aim of a meeting with Mr. Khrushchev at this time, and do you feel that you are meeting him with enough cards in your hand?
The purpose of this meeting is to permit me to make a more precise judgment on those matters which involve the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union and those countries which are associated with us and those countries which are members of the Sino-Soviet bloc. We are involved in two conferences at Geneva. We hope that more progress can be made at both of them. And if there is any thing that may be said in the meetings at Saturday and Sunday, which may improve that prospect, then of course that makes the trip worthwhile. There are other matters also on which we have not come to an agreement with Mr. Khrushchev. And I think it important that we understand fully his viewpoint and all of its implications, and that in return he has the same understanding of our viewpoint. I think that it's most valuable to talk to those with whom we're allied. I also think it's important that we talk to those who are separated from us, because in the final analysis, heavy decisions rest constitutionally upon the President of the United States. He must, under some conditions, make the final judgment himself. And if my judgment may be more lucid, as we may be based more on reality as a result of this exchange, then I think the trip will be useful.
That phrase, those separated from us, deserves a comment of its own, but later. There was another tough question about China.
Mr. President, how can Communist China normalize her relations with the West and be admitted to United Nations membership?
I would say that the normalization of relations, which of course, peaceful relations, which is in the common interest of us all between China and the West, I would hope that they would be brought about. But we desire peace, and we desire to live in amity with the Chinese people. But I will say that since long before I assumed office, and in the first days of our new administration, before really any actions were taken, the attacks upon our government and the United States were constant, immediate, and in many cases malevolent. The debate which took place last fall in the between communist parties indicated that the Chinese planned to take an extremely belligerent attitude and role towards us and those with whom we're associated. We hope that policy changes. We want goodwill, but it takes two to make peace. And I'm hopeful that the Chinese will be persuaded that a peaceful existence with its neighbors represents the best hope for us all. We would welcome it, but I do not see evidence of it today.
A moment ago, Mr. Kennedy said, we must talk to our allies and to those separated from us. And now about Red China, he avoided in his answer the use of the phrase Red China. Obviously, he has in mind the approaching encounter with Khrushchev. Small things can be offensive. He referred to the communists not as our enemies, but as those separated from us. No concession here, no narrowing of the conflict, but an avoidance of offense as the meeting begins. He has in mind, of course, the offense taken by Mr. Khrushchev a year ago of the U-2 incident, which wrecked the Paris meeting with President Eisenhower. Mrs. Kennedy has been very much in the picture, as you know, and she will be again tomorrow when she meets Madame Khrushchev. Let's hear from Sander Van Oker, NBC News in Paris.
Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy leaves with her husband tomorrow morning for Vienna, where people live on memories and whipped cream. Vienna is the city of the Habsburgs, and even though they intermarried with French nobility for centuries, the Viennese are going to have to stretch their imaginations, which they're perfectly capable of doing, to find a link between themselves and French-descended Jacqueline Kennedy. In Paris, there was no such problem. Nothing pleases the French more than to see someone else who's French, or at least who has some French blood, never mind how far back. If they are also chic and can speak French with hardly an accent, this persuades the French the person must be worthy of their consideration and attention. They are not convinced many outsiders are. Everything she's done has attracted attention. Was her hair really cut short by her French hairdresser for the ball at Versailles last night? Not since Samson was shorn of his locks has tonsorial technique been so widely discussed. Was she really as beautiful in person as she seemed to be in her pictures? The answer, obviously, has been yes. The last refuge of a weary reporter is to quote something a taxi driver told him. Taxi drivers, as a breed, have in folklore acquired the collective wisdom of the centuries. Voltaire's on four wheels. We will shun that device tonight. Instead, we relate what one of our NBC drivers, so help us, told us tonight. She is so lovely, he said, so much more lovely and fresh-looking when you see her in person than in pictures. She struck the right note throughout, taking time out to send a telegram to wire her condolences to the family of 19-year-old Danielle Bouvier, her distant relative killed Monday on her way to Paris in the hope of meeting the First Lady. Today in the rain, she came out of an impressionist art gallery. Tourists had been waiting in the rain to see her. She brushed by her police escort to step to the edge of the crowd to allow the people in it to take pictures with their cameras. She seems not to have disappointed anyone, except perhaps the French fashion houses. She wore only one French creation, a gown by Givenchy. The rest came from America. She's apparently following the president's injunction to American tourists to spend more of their money at home. Sandra Van Oker, NBC News, Paris.
One news dispatch about Mrs. Kennedy and the sidewalk photographers says they expressed their gratitude after snapping their photos by crying out, "Merci, Jacqueline!" But did they? A French lady here in New York, hearing this report, said, "Impossible! The French could never be so discourteous as to call the president's wife by her first name." Well, perhaps some of them did, thinking it was a good American custom. The original plan called for the Kennedys to move today from their official quarters in the Quai d'Orsay to the residence of the U.S. Ambassador, James Gavin. But packing was such a problem, especially for Mrs. Kennedy, with 40 pieces of baggage, that they accepted the proposal to remain where they are and to pack only once. The baggage Mr. Kennedy will require beginning tomorrow is more concisely packed. What does he look like by comparison with Chairman Khrushchev? Irving R. Levine, who has served in Moscow, is now in Vienna.
If opposites attract in politics as well as in romance, Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy should get along famously. They are completely different in age, education, family background. Khrushchev, at 67, is old enough to be Mr. Kennedy's father. The Soviet leader began his formal education only at the age of 27 and never got close to the Soviet equivalent of Harvard. Khrushchev was born of a peasant family, worked as a shepherd, miner, and plumber to earn a living. President Kennedy was born with a silver swimming pool. Yet the men do have something in common. Both are energetic, and although Khrushchev said that life is short and man should live it to the fullest, the words well reflect the competitiveness of the Kennedys. Both have a sense of humor which could save their meetings from head-on collision. Both like power and are sensitive to the realities of personal power. That bodes ill because Khrushchev is not much impressed by failures in Laos and Cuba. Khrushchev once expressed surprise that a man so young and relatively inexperienced in government could become America's president. In conversations with diplomats, Khrushchev reflects no great respect for Mr. Kennedy. Their confrontation could change this, yet right now, Khrushchev may share the opinion that in seeking a meeting with him now, Mr. Kennedy is like a boxer who has just lost his last two bouts with sparring partners and is now challenging the champion. This is Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Vienna.
If you or I were in Khrushchev's shoes, we should be well prepared for one thing. President Kennedy has said at almost every milepost on his route to Vienna, "I want to avoid the danger of miscalculation." He said it in Washington before he left. He said it more than once in Paris. And today, very precisely, he said the most recent miscalculation was in Korea,
And here's a quotation, where the North Koreans did not seem certain that we would respond immediately upon the occasion of their invasion into South Korea. Well, the next time this is said, it will be said directly to Nikita Khrushchev, and most probably in connection with Berlin. Khrushchev arrived in Vienna in time to rest and reflect. This might be something to reflect upon. Martin Agronsky in Vienna gives us the arrival scene.
Nikita Khrushchev tonight is doing here in Vienna what for him usually doesn't come naturally. On the eve of the two-day meeting he begins tomorrow with President Kennedy, Mr. K is spending a quiet evening in the palatial mansion maintained by the Russian embassy in the suburb of Pürkersdorf, 10 miles outside of the city. After a half hour spent in the rays of the setting sun in the mansion's quiet garden, the Russian premier appeared to wave a good night to the crowd of waiting reporters, then retired inside. The official motorcycle escort was dismissed. The Khrushchev daughter-in-law, Ilyana, went off to the opera. Four Russians, each equipped with briefcases, arrived to join their chief. And so far, all's quiet in the imperial yellow Soviet country residence at 17 Wintergasse Street, Pürkersdorf. Since Mr. K has demonstrated repeatedly in the past that he is a master of the unexpected at international conferences, no one would really be very surprised to see his stocky, short-legged figure bouncing along the streets of this city tonight. It could be, though, that the rather cool welcome extended by the people of Vienna when he arrived this afternoon influenced Mr. K to take it easy. The official reception left nothing to be desired in the way of protocol and ceremonial. But the small crowd of Viennese who turned out at the railway station to greet Mr. K missed a few boos and some conspicuously weak cheers as he professed his desire for peace and to get to know Mr. Kennedy better. The Russian, in his formal visit to Austria's President Scharf, did not neglect the opportunity to pop out on the balcony outside the president's office. But the Viennese proved a lackadaisical Romeos for Russia's ebullient Juliet, and Mr. K cut short his Viennese balcony scene. This is Martin Agronsky, NBC News, Vienna.
Now, in the final moments, return to Paris. We have saved for the last a portion of the president's news conference. In fact, the opening statement made before the questions popped. We've saved this because it states so clearly what he sees as the stepladder of progress with the Soviets. You can't take the second step until you've taken the first. John Rich mentioned this a moment ago. If we cannot have an agreement on a nuclear test ban, which is relatively simple, how can we go on to the larger question of disarmament involving the same sticking point of inspection? Well, here it is directly in the words of the president.
I come on the same mission which occupied many of my predecessors, stretching all the way back to President Wilson at the conclusion of the First World War. And that is how it is possible to bind more intimately for the common interest France and the United States, Europe and the United States. All of the power relationships in the world have changed in the last 15 years, and therefore our policies must take these changes into account. First is the change in Europe itself. In the 1940s, Europe, much of it was destroyed, its productive capacity liquidated, divided by a bitter war, inflation rampant, and only those who were optimists of the most extreme sort could have ever predicted the astonishing renaissance of Western Europe today. The second great change is the change in weaponry. The United States no longer has a nuclear monopoly. The Soviet Union's possession of atomic and hydrogen weapons has increased its willingness to test and probe and push the West. We still have strong hopes that it will be possible for us to reach an agreement at Geneva on a cessation of nuclear tests. If we cannot reach an agreement on this subject, which is relatively easy to patrol because of the flow of radiation, how is it going to be possible for us to set up the kind of inspection system for the control of other weapons which could lead to disarmament and therefore to a world peace? I consider this to be a most essential, realistic step. Third and most important is the change in the location and the nature of the threat. The cause of freedom is under pressure all over the world. But because of the extraordinary rebirth of Western European strength, the struggle has been switched to other areas where the security of your countries and mine are now being directly threatened. The time has now come for us to associate more closely together than ever in the past in a massive and concerted attack on poverty, injustice, and oppression, which overshadows so much of the globe. We are not spectators today. We are all contributing. We are all involved. Here in this country, here in this community, here in Western Europe, here in my own country, here all around the globe, where it is our responsibility to make a maximum contribution.
That phrase, a massive attack on poverty, constantly returns in the president's thinking, as indeed it did with President Eisenhower. Before we leave Paris, consider the rather remarkable fact that President Kennedy and President de Gaulle have held their series of conversations practically alone, that is, only with interpreters, not with foreign ministers or other advisors. I think this is important in making any appraisal of the success or failure of the encounter. They did fail to reach an agreement on the French contribution to NATO. They did fail to reach an agreement on the sharing of U.S. atomic secrets. They did fail to reach an agreement on French testing of their own atomic weapons. But we cannot draw the conclusion that the conference was a failure unless we assume that they expected to agree on these problems. If they had, they would have come to these meetings with advisors and technicians prepared to discuss details. No, apparently the purpose was for each to take the measure of the other man. In France, de Gaulle is the state, with foreign policy firmly in his own hands. President Kennedy, much more than President Eisenhower, is acting as his own Secretary of State. Dean Rusk did not come to Paris until last night. Between two men of power, in two countries of importance, it was vital that they should establish, as John Rich just put it, a direct line from the White House to the Élysée Palace. And we can hope that Harold King was right when he wrote today, President Kennedy won the deep respect of France's often austere leader. Well, tomorrow to Vienna. It may be a romantic notion, but what a fine world it would be if such an agreement could be reached between the West and Russia that the massive attack on poverty, which Mr. Kennedy spoke about today, could be made jointly rather than in competition. I recall that President Eisenhower, in his first year in office, told the American Society of Newspaper Editors that if the Russians would permit it, we would beat our swords into plowshares and devote the cost of making war to the benefit of the needy peoples of the world. This is Leon Pearson, NBC News.
This has been the fourth and final NBC News report this week on the President in Europe, presented on the NBC Radio Network. On Monday, NBC News will present a summary report on the journey of President Kennedy to see President de Gaulle of France, confer with Russian Premier Khrushchev in Vienna, and wind up meeting Prime Minister Macmillan in London. On the weekend, NBC's Monitor will continue coverage of the Kennedy-Khrushchev meeting with spot news and in-depth reports. The President in Europe was produced by NBC News. Producers Ray Hassan and Art Wakely. Director Daniel Sutter. Every Sunday, a review of the week's news on Weekend Report on many of these NBC stations.